This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Infamous and lionized, that's how literary critic, provocateur Camille Paglia describes the supreme poet of American Romanticism, Walt Whitman. It could describe Paglia, too. For 20 years, she's been shaking up the literary world with her wickedly sharp words and ways. A year ago, she came out with a zinging collection of essays on great poems. At the heart of it, Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, the great rhapsody to freedom. "I speak the password primeval," he wrote. "I give the sign of democracy." It was revolutionary 150 years ago. This hour, we'll look at how it lights up Americans' understanding of what freedom means today. Up next on Point, Camille Paglia and Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. Joining me now in the studio, and I'm delighted to have her, Camille Paglia, one of the country's most celebrated cultural and literary critics. She's professor of humanities and media studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, author of Sexual Personae, Art and Arts and Decadence from Nefertiti to Emily Dickinson in Vamps and Tramps. Her book, Break, Blow, Burn, Camille Paglia Reads 43 of the World's Best Poems, just came out in paperback. Camille Paglia, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here again.
I've got to tell you, this book has become my companion. I love just dipping into it. It sits at my bedside. It's a real favorite. I've enjoyed it enormously.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. I spent 5 years on it, so it's very gratifying.
Well, it's just great. I mean, you've chosen wonderful poems, and you illuminate them so wonderfully. So many, you bring the Paglia sort of zest to so many angles here. And I read this one, and I said to myself, I think it was late at night. I was in a hot and steamy bath. I'm reading, and suddenly I'm reading out loud along, and here we've got Whitman, and Whitman's in the air, and I'm like, wow, what a spirit. You say he's the supreme poet of American Romanticism, but there it is. It was just so vivid and powerful. I said, let's have Camille back and talk about this one out of your 43. Remind us of Walt Whitman, who he was, how he was received 150 years ago last year when this all hit America.
Well, Walt Whitman's style is really what separates American literature from European literature. It makes all the difference between American poetry of the 20th century and let's say, British poetry today. Whitman was a radical revolutionary in terms of his style. He broke all convention, all form. He began as an editor of newspapers. He worked as a journalist. He batted around. He came from a kind of working class background. He liked to explore. He was rather a disassociated type. Some people want to claim that he's gay, but I personally view him as gay tending, but very solitary type whose entire erotic life is contained in this magnificent poetry, which is like it's like grand opera, right? But when his work first came out, it caused a tremendous scandal, a major scandal. He was considered a disreputable, pornographic. He lost a job because of it. It was one of the first great sort of arguments over censorship in the history of American publishing. And then the sheer emotional exuberance, the expressiveness of the style influenced everyone. Emerson was an early supporter, so Whitman was lucky in that to have one of these sort of mandarins of the literary establishment to defend him. But to the end of his life, he was considered disreputable and even by conservative critics sloppy. He was thought to be sloppy, amateurish. Right? But what he was doing was turning poetry toward the vernacular, toward the common idiom.
Almost opening it up to jazz. Almost making it jazz.
Yes, okay. And what you're getting is all kinds of new rhythms that had never been heard before in poetry. He doesn't observe the ends of lines. There's a sense of a torrent, of an overflow. He really is, he has had a tremendous influence over a century. For example, he is the grandfather, really, of the beat movement. Allen Ginsberg owed everything to him. Okay, and Allen Ginsberg was directly influenced by African-American jazz, mm-hmm. and it's bop phase. So you really mm-hmm. see that that weird kind of parallelism between Whitman's work and African American rhythm and blues and the whole
Ginsberg and the Beats and right on through. Mm-hmm. You say he was considered absolutely impudent in the way he came at this when it first came.
It was
this
shocking. Torrent of
skitter, playful zigzags, just didn't play by the rules. I want to get this. I want to get deep into this. I want to think about his notion of freedom, about how he exercised it in poetry, about how we understand our freedom today. But I want to get it in our ear. Of course, this was part of Leaves of Grass, great big collection that he worked and worked on, revived many times.
It was really never done. It was just always in process.
Always in process, and right in the middle of it, Song of Myself, maybe the most important poem in the entire collection. Here we've got, it's 52 sections long. It's very long. You've looked at the first section and an excerpt of the 24th. We'll hear both of those, but let's hear the first one first. This is read by Ed Begley, the actor, not junior, but senior. Here it is, Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, Section 1.
I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents born here, from parents the same, and their parents the same. I, now 37 years old, in perfect health, begin, hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad, I permit to speak at every hazard, nature, without check, with original energy.
I permit to speak at every hazard, nature. Walt Whitman there, the first section of Song of Myself, read by Ed Begley, and it begins with I.
Mm-hmm.
I, the great American I.
Well, it was considered quite vulgar at the time, okay, to promote yourself. It's really the, kind of the sound of American advertising. But here, Whitman makes himself the central character of his poem, which is exactly what Dante did, for heaven's sakes, in the Divine Comedy. But here, Whitman is not offering himself as an interpreter of God's law, but rather as a kind of conduit for the force of American nature, the fertility of the land itself. So he's a man, but yet he makes himself empty. Okay, for these enormous propulsive rhythms that are coming from this great land of America that he feels is pure, is good, that should in no way be subordinate to European models.
And not just I, but he wraps that I over everything. What I assume, you shall assume. How presumptuous can you get, or is it something else?
It's very intrusive, literary terms, for a poet to almost leap over the boundary line, okay, between himself and the audience. He embraces the audience. Indeed, he hectors the audience. It's almost like a kind of enforced marriage. I've described it as a shotgun marriage, right, between the author and the audience.
A mystical shotgun wedding.
Yes.
And for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. That's where I started to sort of draw some line between then and now, or at least his sense then. And I mean, do Americans still share that? What did he mean by that? Every atom that belongs to me as well as belongs to you, what was Whitman's in?
He's almost imagining the mind having penetrated the body and becoming pure spirit, and we're all in this enormous sense of unity of destiny and presence on the American land. But it's also a statement, as everywhere in this poem, against materialism. This was the new kind of go-go era of American industrialism just beginning, and he's saying in effect, okay, that. A life based on acquisition of property and money and so on, social status, that these things are nothing compared to the enormity of this whatever it is, this great spirit, which is America. He feels animated, you know, by it. It's almost a kind of divine force. He really is the first, it's an anthem creator, let's say, you know, of mm-hmm. the idea of America, the idea of liberty.
Do we still read it? Do we still hear it the way he meant it at the time, or is it something else?
Well, people who do read the poem do, I believe, feel it. Unfortunately, you know, I'm not so sure that great poetry is anymore at the center of our culture.
Let's put that voice right in our ears. This, a wax cylinder recording of what is thought to be Walt Whitman's voice. It's not A Song of Myself. It's the poem America. Just got four lines here, but let's hear it, just to have the voice of the man, we think, in our ears.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and good, grown, ungrown, young or old, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love.
Walt Whitman, we believe, on a wax cylinder recording from way back when, the last two lines of the poem, not there, a grand, sane, towering, seated mother, that is America, chaired in the adamant of time. And there's a theme that comes right to a song of myself. Center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike, all endeared, grown, ungrown, young or old. Neopalia, you say, the epic theme in Song of Myself is not war or moral struggle, but expansion of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. So, to me, as a product of the 1960s, he speaks directly to my generation with our interest in Hinduism, which partly influenced him.
Through Emerson, maybe.
Yes, and you know, Emerson also was very interested in Asian ideas of nature, but Emerson was never able to write a poem that was as successful as Whitman's poem, never really able to embody it. He was too much trapped, really, in his own mind, his own cultivation, in a way. But Whitman is trying to liberate the senses, and for him, a sexual response is simply part of our sensory reaction, okay, to everything around us, to open the eyes, to observe, you know, to perceive. There's a kind of ecstasy always in Whitman, an ecstasy of being alive. I think that's the thing. It forces you to break free of the, you know, the small selves that we have to inhabit to work in an office, you know, do a job. We have certain social roles that we're forced to conform to.
But he says loaf, lean, right, and right. Loaf. And this is when industrialization was booming, and loaf, you say, was kind of jazzy new language.
Absolutely. Loaf does not belong in a major poem. It's slang. And he's protesting against the Protestant work ethic. He's saying, in effect, that our greater lives, our more important lives, are in response to the great forces of nature.
My tongue, he says, is driven to speak. It pokes, it erupts from the soil like a plant shoot. He's saying, I'm kind of in the thrall. I can't help it. This is me.
Yes, he says his voice itself is coming out of him. His poetry is compulsive. Okay? That it's not something willed. It's just an enormous natural force that's cascading through him. He has to serve it. And this is in the main line of English Romanticism, where Shelley appeals to the west wind to speak through him, or where Wordsworth tries to open himself also to the forces of nature. But no one really succeeded with as extended an ode style as Whitman did. I do feel it's our parallel to Italian grand opera of the same era.
And maybe a parallel here to Dante. I mean, he's not a very young man here. He says, I now, 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to cease not till death, waking up in midlife like Dante in the mm-hmm. Divine Comedy. Why then? What was going on in his life?
Well, he finally is discovering, I think, his true poetic identity. He finally is, in his mind, assuming the role of the bard, the spokesman for his culture, in the same way as Homer had been. He wants to accumulate everything. He wants to swallow everything and then have it come out again in these enormously propulsive lines.
Gosh, it's just impossible not to be swept up in this. Creeds and schools in abeyance. He says, "Don't overwhelm me with creeds, please."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. He doesn't want religious dogma. He doesn't want schools of philosophy. He's not interested in academic disputes. He says, "Just hold them back." Right? They were good once. There was a time in history when they sufficed when people learned from them. But now, no more. Okay? Now we must have nature without check with original energy. Nature becomes the God force, the divine force of the universe for him.
We're talking about Walt Whitman's Song of Myself with Camille Paglia. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Matt's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
This is so great. I was going to drive into work, and I just turned around and came back home so I could listen to you guys.
We're right there with you. We're right down
you.
In the grass.
Rather than comparing Whitman to jazz in general, I've always thought that he should be compared to the tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. I don't know if you're familiar with his work
sure.
at all.
Yeah.
But Sonny Rollins is one of these guys who nature and life energy is just pouring through him, and his playing takes on this characteristic of lists of every possible thing,
right.
including references to millions of tunes he's heard. Mm. I've always felt with Whitman that he gets into this kind of, he's plugged into the universal lists and everything.
Yeah. On yeah. and on connected. And on, yes.
Yeah, it's the catalog style, the catalogs
yes.
of epic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you got a visual reference for it, Sonny Rollins on tenor sax, what about visually, Matt?
Jackson Pollock.
Mm.
Splatter that paint.
Sonny Rollins and Walt Whitman will be appearing next Friday at a local bar. And
wouldn't that be great?
Jackson Pollock is a perfect analogy because a Pollock at his high creative point would go into a trance and he would really dance. He would be possessed by the rhythms of music and would dance around the edges of his canvas laid out on the floor. And you would get the paint spattering, not coming from his hand or even from his arm, but from his shoulders and his torso. And that when the beat poets would recite, they would do the same thing. They would dance up and down behind the microphone, and that's absolutely almost canonical. Okay, for American culture, this is what separates us from the Brits. Okay, the British are not going to dance up and down. Okay, behind
Let's
a
read
microphone.
And dance, right. Matt. You're caught in this net just like we are. In this beautiful, luminous net. He's got at the end of this first section: nature without check, with original energy. You hear it in Sonny Rollins. You see it in Jackson Pollock. Look around in American culture today. Do you see this energy, this freedom flowing, Matt?
I don't know, but rock on, Camille.
thanks.
Take care.
Thank you.
Great. Right. Matt, thanks for calling. Camille, how about you? You're a big critic
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. I think the
Is it pumping?
No, the arts are in a kind of doldrum now. It could be partly the political moment, which is uncertain. But I do think that that the arts in practically every area lack this kinds of these gusts of self-confidence and of sense of mission that you feel in Whitman. And part of it is that, the Academy is infested with post-structuralism and post-modernism, which is anti-nature. It does not allow even that nature exists. Nothing exists but language to them. Right? And slowly but surely, this kind of ideology has seeped into, I think, our best and our brightest.
The culture's a lot bigger than academia.
Irony. No, but the irony, the cynicism, okay, that comes out of postmodernism, it's everywhere. It's in Letterman, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, I cannot bear watching the Letterman show, okay? With this snide kind of standing to the side and in this kind of posture of being somehow superior. Nothing is really worth committing to. Please. Okay, read Walt Whitman. Okay.
We're going to commit to Whitman for a minute here. Listeners, we're going to dive in to a good full 2.5 minutes of Walt Whitman. This is with section 24 out of the 52. Camille, set us up a little bit here because he begins, this is going to be Orson Welles' reading. It's rather rotund. It's not exactly freewheeling, but he begins with Walt Whitman, A Cosmos, of Manhattan, the Sun. Just tell us what he means by that. Of Manhattan, the Sun.
Well, Whitman is actually a native of
Long Island, Brooklyn. Yeah.
And he's talking about the not Manhattan, the borough that we know today, okay, but rather the Manahatta Indian tribe. He feels that that he himself traces his spiritual lineage to the Native Americans, those who worship the same powers of nature that he feels.
So here it is. This is Orson Welles reading section 24 from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, and you're going to hear it. Turbulent, fleshy, sensual. Bear with us. It's 2.5 minutes. Enjoy. Here we go.
Walt Whitman, a cosmos of Manhattan, the sun. Turbulent, fleshy, sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding. No sentimentalist, no stander above men and women or apart from them. No more modest than immodest. Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams. Whoever degrades another degrades me, and whatever is done or said returns at last to me. Through me the afflatus, surging and surging. Through me the current and index. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. Through me, many long dumb voices, voices of the interminable generations of prisoners and slaves, voices of the diseased and despairing, and of thieves and dwarfs, voices of cycles of preparation and accretion, and of the threads that connect the stars, and of wombs, and of the father stuff, and of the rights of them the others are down upon, of the deformed, trivial, flat, foolish, despised, fog in the air, beetles rolling balls of dung. Through me, forbidden voices, voices of sexes and lusts, voices veiled, and I remove the veil, voices indecent by me clarified and transfigured. I do not press my fingers across my mouth. I keep as delicate around the bowels as around the head and heart. Copulation is no more rank to me than death is. I believe in the flesh and the appetites, seeing, hearing, feeling, the miracles, and each part and tag of me is a miracle.
Each part and tag of me, a miracle. It's Orson Welles, none other than, reading Walt Whitman's Song of Myself with Camille Paglia. What do you hear? There's a lot to dive into here, and we will. Don's calling from Northfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi there. It's great to hear Walt Whitman on the radio.
Yeah, it's great to have him.
One of my heroes.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe this is a different slant than you've spoken about before. I've only heard it for your show part of the time.
Dive in.
But I think that what we're hearing in Whitman is something, well, we should have, Western culture especially, but the world should have heard then and is in desperate need of now.
What is it?
We're given, well, embracing life as it is, and that we share this common destiny. The thread of life is so interconnected that, and the way to understand that and to experience that is the embracing of life. And when you do that, some of the excesses we are experiencing globally of energy glut, climate change, and all that, you know, we need an antidote.
He says, by God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. That's hardly the way it's working right now.
That's right. And that's where, you know, I live in a beautiful rural part of our state, and I got to say, I think that I've learned so much from actually trying to work with the land a little bit and do something for ourselves that even though I had past experience, and I think that a lot of us don't have enough to understand how well connected we are to everything else and how we're dependent we are.
Camille Paglia, you're nodding. And Don, thanks for your call.
Yes, I mean, I think that that's actually was the vision, the great vision of the 1960s generation that's been lost somehow. You know, that that you have everything. It's around you. That actually, you know, Emerson had the idea of self-reliance, and of course Thoreau did, but you know, by going out to Walden Pond. But you know, how few people really try to put it into practice. These are lessons that Buddhism teaches, okay, but also great poetry like Whitman. You own everything, okay? And there's this striving after after empty objects and after status. Ultimately, when you're dead, you're dead, okay? And so you should enjoy life now and embrace the life principle. That's actually what's in his work.
And he jumps right in and does it. The fleshy, the sensual, eating, drinking, breeding. You say this was mundane naturalism. This was supposed to be for the flunkies, Sancho Panza in Cervantes, or Falstaff in Shakespeare. Now he makes that the heroic.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And of course, it's explicitly anti-Christian, which is one reason it was very shocking then.
By his own definition? By his own intent?
It's a kind of radical pantheism, right, that's that's saying he rejects the message of shame about sex in the Judeo-Christian heritage. And
there's a very Christ-like reference to through me, voices clarified and transfigured, voices indecent.
It is very it's an act of hubris on his part, right, to put himself in the position of Christ. But he is, we would say, valorizing, okay, the appetites. But Judeo-Christianity has said that you must gain control of your appetites. Those are the seven deadly sins. Mm-hmm, right? And what Whitman is saying is that there is no sin. There is no sin. That the body itself is naturally pure. And this is a radical view of the body that no one had really enunciated since the end of Greco-Roman paganism. Mm. But it was people were. Emily Dickinson has a little note about one of her letters about Whitman. She said,
Was he denounced from the pulpit?
I don't know from the pulpit. Okay, but there's no doubt it caused a tremendous controversy. Dickinson says, "I have not read Mr. Whitman's work, but I have heard it's quite shocking."
I've not read it, but I've heard it's quite shocking.
Yeah, but she was intrigued by it. But I doubt that her father would have necessarily had it in the house.
Yeah. Well, we're picking it up today, and we're having a good time with it, and we're going to hear more. Carrie's calling from West Union, Iowa. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I was calling because actually I felt rather bad because listening to you guys talk about Whitman and the enthusiasm, I felt like I was tortured with Whitman when I was in school.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. In what school when, Carrie?
Well,
what level?
Of course, in high school.
Uh-huh.
But then. By your readings, good God, they would have never taught that in high school, the way you're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And even in college, I was an English major, and it wasn't taught with this much enthusiasm.
Mm.
And I just suffered through it, and I've had my book out reading while I've been listening, and you know what, maybe if they would have got a little more into it, I would have enjoyed it, but I just, even to this day, I don't. And the readings you've been having on the deep, sonorous voices
Orson
and all the weight, and it just turns me off. I don't know why, because it's ideas that I believe in and would, love to get behind. But
right, and yet, Camille, what do you want to say to Carrie?
Well, this is why I spent 5 years writing Break, Blow, Burn, because the way poetry is taught is too often sort of enervating and boring. I mean, I certainly had my experience of this in high school. It's spirit-killing. And in fact, poetry could not be more opposite. Poetry is enormously liberating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you want to run around or roll in the grass naked.
There you go. That's just what he wants.
Now you're in the
Whitman has succeeded. Okay,
watch out for the neighbors.
It's exactly what he's
cold to do it this morning. But
maybe not today. Take
exactly
a song first.
What he's counseling. He's rolling in the grass. He actually says that.
Carrie,
I love Hart Crane, and he comes out of Whitman's movement, but I can't get Whitman.
Well, we hope it grabs you and takes you away. We hope you'll roll in the snow and roll in the grass, and we thank you for your call. Camille, I mean, he's just blasting on the trumpet here. Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from the jams. What are we unscrewing here?
Well, it works on so many different levels. He's talking on the most blatant level about the idea of sexual shame. There's nothing to be embarrassed about in sexuality. He wants it to end to guilt. guilt, you know, from which he believes is the heritage of religion. But he also wants to break down the barriers between people. People lock a door to protect their property. And he's saying in a truly emancipated humanity would not need to have these barriers of jealousy and of, you know, and of in armaments, okay, literally, you know,
Walls, doors, barriers, but not that, just that even. I mean, he's even going to the kind of Newtonian geometry. The romantic in him is even... Is he, you tell me, pushing against the science?
He's exploding the architecture, okay, of civilization, okay, and saying, you know, we need to, again, return to nature. Now, that's the, it definitely is a contrast he's making between what we'd call, you know, social constructionism, okay, and the organic. He feels that there is a salvation and purification in, to quote your caller, rolling around in the grass, okay, a kind of whole body response.
Right.
So for him, you know, the locked door is also the mind. Okay, you have to like break the mind free. The body should not be dictated to by the brain, and there should be like a sort of free flow of energy, you know, throughout the body. All these things are actually, you know, contained in Hinduism and Buddhism too. Mm-hmm. So it's remarkable that you're getting him in this idiom of romantic poetry.
Richard's calling from Hanover, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Miss Polly.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed your writings over the years greatly, and I'll buy this new book, obviously. My question is funny. I just read Sylvia Plath's poem recently on her father.
Yes.
Which was so remarkably powerful, I couldn't believe the two pages. But in any event, if you look at Whitman, what's the impact of, for example, Bacon and essayist Montaigne and Shakespeare upon his writings, the historical people who are 200 years removed from him? Because it seems that 19th century period with Emerson, I just finished Mind on Fire, that was a remarkable period of people writing. It was just so powerful compared to what I see today.
Well, the more direct influence is coming from English Romanticism. So what you're seeing is a slightly delayed response to Wordsworth and Coleridge and so on. But it gets intertwined in 19th century America with the Puritan heritage, which is still actually entrenched in America. No matter how big America gets, in some way our ideas are still under the shadow of the, you know, the very committed Puritan dissidents who came over here and who are ultimately responsible for our quarrels today between politics and religion. So I think, you know, the more immediate quarrel, you know, the war for Whitman is to try to eradicate what he feels is this strangling Puritanism in still in American culture. And interestingly, you mentioned Shakespeare himself and his co-workers in the theater world in London were constantly at war with the Puritans who were fulminating from the pulpits and calling for the closure of the theaters, okay, which eventually would indeed happen with the Cromwell Revolution.
Chris, thanks for Richard, thanks for your call. Chris is calling from Baltimore. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, sir?
We're great. What do you think, Chris?
I'm listening to this poem for the first time, and it's just it's amazing how much it's connecting with me, and I drive for a living, and I spend many, many hours just thinking my own thoughts, and it just seems to be articulating and creating in me kind of an alchemy with this man that didn't exist, and now I want to go home and...
We love it. What do you drive, Chris? What are you driving, my friend?
I'm sorry, I drive a truck for a living.
And it's resonating with you, the rhythm, the ideas, the words.
Everything. I'm kind of an amateur poet myself, and I write in my head a lot, and sometimes I actually even put it on paper, and there are so many things going on with this poem that if I could have, I would have connected with a long time ago, you know.
Chris, I completely love it, and I love you driving your truck and reading it. And there is this, I mean, in the most respectful way, I mean, there is a populism in here. There's no poet to read better. Mm-hmm. The academic don and the truck driver, every mm-hmm. American, just jump right. in. And right. he says it so explicitly.
Oh, Whitman is he despises the idea of social class. He feels that all manual labor, you know, is in fact ennobling. Okay, so he despises snobbery of any kind, and so this is one of the things he's always trying to break down. The notion of social class. I mean, it's even relevant to his extreme position on he's an abolitionist. I mean, he takes that position. But many of the leading abolitionists, there were many very well cultivated middle class ladies, mm-hmm. New England ladies, mm-hmm. and so on. They didn't necessarily have a rapport, let's say, with the black working class. Okay, they certainly were. Colleagues of the formidable Frederick Douglass. But what you're getting in Whitman, okay, is an embrace of the working class, white and black, and he declares that we are comrades. Okay, and there's a sense of collegiality that he has with them. It's both physical and spiritual.
Chris, we feel you in the truck right there. We know you're listening and you're working. We'll share a little bit more once again. Whitman, I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. Happy trails, Chris.
Thank you.
Camille, by God, I will accept nothing. I mean, there's a sentiment that seems nothing that everybody can have their counterpart of. That seems a very out-of-date sentiment in our time of, I don't know, $500 million CEO pay packages.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, it's grotesque. Okay, the economic disparities that are that are so obvious. Just today, just drive through Manhattan and you have to be repelled. Okay, by the by the blatant ostentation of the nouveau riche now. But Whitman is saying, in effect, when he speaks of the primeval, he's saying we must go back to the beginning of life and start over. He feels that democracy is something that's already destined, okay, that all the more artificial societies with their elaborate hierarchies and ranks and so on, these things came afterward and must be swept away. So he says, if we go back to the beginning and realign ourselves with nature, okay, then we are filled with the spirit of democracy. Therefore, America itself, you see, the whole democratic experiment in America, he is arguing, is coming directly from the grandeur of American geography.
Mm, we're feeling it. Michelle's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Mm. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, nice to talk to you today.
Sure.
I just sent a letter off to a good friend of mine whose mother got cancer, and I always go to other writers for those momentous occasions, and I went to Walt Whitman. Mm-hmm. I looked at this book, Writers in Art, with George Bellows, and along with his Art of Nature, there was a lot of quotes of Walt Whitman.
And what's the line you sent, Michelle?
Well, there's a couple from Song of Myself, about God and understanding God or not understanding God and finding them within ourselves and within nature. And I think at the end it says something like, there is no better day than today to see God. And I find now that I'm about to turn 40 that the lexicon of death is entering my life and my friends' lives. And I tend to go to Walt Whitman a lot because he celebrates experiencing the now and questioning the bigger questions within ourselves and within nature, but also saying that we do have the answers and that we do know what's going on.
Michelle, we love it. Our time is so short, but I thank you for your call. I got a last question for you, Camille, and we're going to hear just a little bit more. I mean, in some ways, the country's never been more various. This is celebrating the everything that Whitman celebrates. In another way, there's a sense of confinement, fear, lost hopefulness, limits. So where in that spectrum of Whitman's cosmos are we swimming today?
Well, Whitman was the great figure at a time when the nation tore itself apart in the Civil War. He put his poetic gifts in the service of trying to heal the nation.
And himself as a kind of nurse in the war, healing the wounded.
He absolutely put himself on the line. He comforted the sick and the dying. Mm. And he just was a model of your personal compassion.
There it is. Somewhere in there we swim today. It's been great looking at this with you again. There's so much more we could do. We'll have to do it another time. We're going to hear a little more before we go out. Camille Paglia has been with us. Her book is Break, Blow, Burn. Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems. I recommend it to you. Camille, it's wonderful to have you with
us. Thanks, Tom. I think what you've done is fabulous, okay, for radio.
Well, it's just great to have you. We're going to go out hearing the last of the 52 sections, Ed Begley reading the last section of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, read here by actor Ed Begley Sr. Let's listen to just a little bit more Walt Whitman.
The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. The last scud of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shadowed wilds. It coaxes me to the vapor in the dusk. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you.
Ed Begley Sr. reading the final section, section 52 of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. Thanks to Camille Paglia for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.